I'm Nikki.
And I'm Kirtana.
And you're listening to The Chat Room.
Oh, you know where I went 2 weeks ago? Or 3 weeks ago? Sorry, 4 weeks ago?
How many weeks ago? How many weeks ago was it?
Time is a construct.
Where did you go 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks ago?
I went to the Renaissance Fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you bring your flail and drink a pint of mead?
I speak English. I don't know what the hell just happened there. But
I said, did you bring your flail and drink a pint of mead?
What's a flail?
A flail is like the little ball with the spikes, and then it, like, you hold it by the chain and you just whip it at people.
All right. I want you to just re-say that definition of what a flail is, and then ask me again if I brought one.
Did you bring a flail? Listen, you said Renaissance Fair, okay?
I bought a flower crown. I got the opposite of a flail.
See, I would bring a flail.
You know who would never wield a weapon because he's the kindest person on this earth?
Oh, God. I can't. I'm walking away. Goodbye. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that that audio clip where you can do like the sound of a shutting door and walking away. Who would never wield a flail? Tell me.
Out of the three of us, who is most likely to wield a flail? Me. Let's be honest. Who's the least likely? Dunnage. Let's be honest.
All right, Nikki, tell the folks who Dunnage is.
This week, we are so excited to have the wonderful Dunnage Chopra on our podcast. He is a writer, director, producer, and showrunner. I had to take a breath there. With 5 feature films to his name. His first feature, Punching at the Sun, is about South Asian teenagers coming of age in a post-9/11 Queens, and that premiered at Sundance and Tribeca in 2006.
I don't think I realized when we talked to him that he had 5 feature films.
Yeah, I didn't either. Like, it's kind of crazy how we request bios after we record episodes, and some of these folks are just, they stay humble. Like, they're not name dropping as much as they should.
Dunnage's most recent feature, Staycation, won the Grand Jury Prize at the 2018 LA Film Festival in the Muse section. He was also selected for the 2018 Sundance Episodic Lab, the Fox Global Filmmaker Initiative, and the Sony TV Directors Lab.
He is currently showrunning and directing Delhi Crime on Netflix, as well as developing several other TV and film projects. But Delhi Crime was... I feel like that was one of the shows. I feel like it was Delhi Crime, Sacred Games, and that initial wave of like, whoa, content out of India can be fire. Like TV shows out of India can be amazing.
When Sacred Games and like Mirzapur came out, I was like, okay, this is like good Indian TV content. But then when Delhi Crime came out and, you know, we had such a focus on such an important topic where we had such a powerful female lead at the center.
Yeah.
That's when I was like, this feels like it can be a turning point. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And there are two things I love about this interview with Dunnage. One is I think he's just such a perfect example of how being kind and doing the work can take you very far and take you so far such that like his rise to becoming a showrunner is very unlike a normal showrunner, which I'm really glad, you know, we had him. I feel like if Dunnage lived in medieval times, he would potentially wield a sword.
I feel like if any of us lived in medieval times, we'd all be dead from the plague by now.
That's also true. Wow.
Wah, wah.
Yikes. I got dark real quick. Anyways, enjoy the interview. Can I point something out before we start? Are we all wearing green right now?
I mean, it's 4:20.
That's why I wore green too.
I mean, I didn't even plan that.
So I knew that I was going to say that.
No, I'm wearing green because it's laundry day.
I don't actually plan on getting high today. I did have a green cupcake, sugar high. I feel like maybe that kind of counts, but I will not be getting high today. Oh my God, and his water bottle is green. This is...
Are you sure you're not high, Nikki?
I know, yes. Maybe I am.
You all right? How you doing today?
Dunnage, thank you for being on this podcast. You know I adore you. Tanaj is one of the nicest, most genuine, kindest, hardworkingest, I don't even know if that's a word, people in this industry. And you, I feel like you just fly so under the radar, which is probably why you're so successful. And I'm really excited to have you on because I think you've had a really interesting journey up until now. And I think a lot of people will either relate to it or aspire to do something similar. And so, yeah, thank you for being on with us.
Oh, Nikki, thanks for having me.
And I saw an active flush just then. Like, I know, an active, literal turn away. You know, like in the Bollywood movies where people go like this? Like, I saw one of those moves.
The look is completes the thought.
That's it. That's what I saw just now. It is.
Still have some. No, I mean, it's so cool you guys do this and give us a space to talk. I mean, I haven't talked to anybody today, so you're just getting me needing to be social here on this podcast. Who knows what'll come out, but thank you for giving me, you know, a space to talk about my stuff.
And I'm always looking for an excuse to talk to you. Yeah. So let's get into it. First question is always my favorite question. What has been your path into the industry thus far? I want to hear the highs, the lows. How'd you tell your parents? What do they think? What do they think now? Let's get into it.
Yeah. I mean, those are all big questions, all separate questions. They can all be expanded on for about an hour each, but I'll just try and keep it kind of the highlights, you know, because like every South Asian person, I get, you know, it, unless you're from the industry, it's frowned upon, but it's so unknown. Like, they don't know what you're saying. They don't know what it means when you say you want to make a film or you want to send a message. They just don't know what it is half the time. So a lot of it, you know, we internalize it as maybe rejection or they're not supporting us or not supportive is the word I hear, but you know, a lot of it is just fear and sticking to what people have known. My parents have always been really cool people. Like, they're just cool people. Like, they've, you know, nurtured me in terms of anything I've been interested in or wanted to, you know, pursue for the most part. But obviously this wasn't their ideal or choice. They've probably publicly and privately expressed concerns. But I think what you do is you keep showing them wins. You know, you keep showing them things that you do over and over, right? I mean, Nikki and I were talking about this the other day. I was at school as an undergrad at Brown, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't have a career major. I was put on academic probation at one point, if you can believe it. Wow. And then it was only after I started studying film, you know, and taking the classes and doing summer school and whatever. When I got onto that track, I saw my grades improving. I saw, you know, just, I was happy. I was doing what I wanted to do. I didn't know what the future held. And I think the big change was, like, I got to take a sight and sound class at NYU one summer, and I got to make six short films, 5-minute films in 6 weeks, you know, and we shot on film. We cut on Steenbecks. It was just like on the street carrying a 50-pound camera in New York. And so that showed me what I had, because I finished the class. I did all my films, and not everybody could even last through. It's like, if you don't love it, you can't keep taking that. And, you know, that class led to me getting into the filmmaking class as a senior. And then I got to make my first short film that got into the Asian American Film Festival of Los Angeles. My very first acceptance, it was from that festival. And I got to show that paper to my parents and say, like, hey, you know, look, my film got in somewhere. That's a big deal. That was a big deal. It was validating, you know, and it gave me just enough to go to the next thing. A family friend was doing a documentary on an orphanage in Patiala and was like, can you just film some stuff for us? So I had a small mini DV camera. I went out there and shot a bunch of stuff, which led me to getting a job in India, producing an arts and culture TV show for Doordarshan for a year. But then
Doordarshan, yeah.
All that time, I got to put together a package of things. I had my short film. I had a bunch of my shorts. And I had my work from Doordarshan, and I did, you know, I did my work. I put together a little bit of what I'd shot at this orphanage with these young women telling their stories of being held at gunpoint by terror. Just like crazy, intense stories of lives that, you know, we know nothing about. And I got to put together this package. I sent it to Columbia for film school application. They gave me I got a call in India, and they said, you've gotten your highest, we're giving you the highest award our school can give you, a Dean's Fellowship. We want you to come to our school next year. And it was the only school I got into, but, you know, it was a win, another win. And I think that's sort of how you have to kind of do it. You have to take a leap of faith, like live with uncertainty, be brave. You know, you have to show people wins. Like, you have to show them you're working towards it. It's not just about saying you want to do it and sitting on a couch and talking about all the things you're going to do. So I think I was steadily backing things up, you know, and that led me to what I felt was like my entry into at least filmmaking. You know, I wouldn't say it's an industry entry point, but it took a little bit of that kind of like faith and grit.
It's your entry into filmmaking, which is your entry into the industry. Because like the thing I feel like is important to kind of like think about whenever you want to like do things in this business is just be like, just start doing it. And that means that means you've done it. You know what I mean? It's like if you've like taken your phone out to make a film, or if you've like gotten your friends together to shoot something or whatever, or write something or whatever, you're doing it. Like that, that is it. You know what I mean?
It's even more specific than that too. It's like, I want to make this film. This film needs to be made right now at this time in this space because this story needs to be told. I mean, I don't want to make it seem like I casually started studying the shit and fell in love with it. Like I was a very political kid. Like I believed in, you know, a lot more representation on TV. I felt like we, especially South Asians, we were represented so shittily, you know, as teens, cab drivers, terrorists, you know, just stereotypes. So I always wanted to make something that could change our perception.
Yeah. I'm also really happy that you admitted being on academic probation, because I was also on academic probation, and it's not something that I talk about very frequently because I was on it when I was, you know, studying math and science, and that just wasn't my thing. And I took that academic probation very personally, as in like, I'm an idiot, I'm stupid, you know, this and that. And it wasn't that. I was using my brain to study the wrong thing with all this purpose. And then as soon as I pivoted into something that I loved and had a talent and passion for, my grades went up. Like it was as simple as that.
You don't see it. The funny thing about academic probation is you don't see it happening. It happens to you. That's one of the few things that happens to you. But it worked, but it's there for a reason. Like, it's there to be like, what are you doing, dude? Refocus, like, figure out your shit.
Yeah, that's so true.
But also, I like the other thing that you brought up too, which is like, you know, talking about like, you got in somewhere and it may have been the only place you got into, but that's a win. But like, you got in, that's the win, period.
Yeah.
You know, a win is a win. You got in somewhere. That is like, that's your validating thing. You did it. You got in and you went and you got to do the thing you wanted.
It's a huge, Kirtan, I'm glad you brought it. It's a huge message for filmmakers, because sometimes I think, you just want to win everything. You want to win all the time. Even all the people you see, all your heroes, you might be perceiving them as always winning or always getting what they want or doing whatever they want in the industry. And it's just not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, the story of success in filmmaking, for especially when you're coming up, you can live with 100 rejections if you get that one win. If you get that one door that opens, that's all you're looking for, is the one door that opens. And you know, it's, I see it time and time again. People get so discouraged because one person says something negative about a script, or one person says, has a comment on a cut that just takes them out of their belief in themselves. You know, where I'm at now, I take 50 notes a day. I don't know. I take tons of notes every day. I take notes and notes and notes. And somewhere in each note is a reason why that note was written. Somewhere there's a message. There's something for me to take from that note. And you kind of have to get past any of these quick knee-jerk like feelings of like, oh, my work sucks, or that they didn't get the cut. Or you know, hearing the word no and understanding what to take from it is really important.
I'm really curious though, like, what was it for you that made you feel like, okay, like this is it. This is what I want to do. Were there like things that you grew up on that you kind of pointed to? Like, did you have certain inspirations where you were like, this made me feel this way and that's what I want to do? Like, what did that look like for you emotionally?
Wow, yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot, it's a great question. I mean, there's been a lot of those moments along the way, especially as a kid, like as a teenager, as you know, a young person, you know, you really like, film is just so fucking cool. It's just so cool. We just always feel so fucking cool whenever you're watching a movie, whenever you try to dress like your favorite character, whenever you like try to recite your favorite piece of dialogue from your favorite movies. Like, it's just it's the coolest fucking thing. You just feel fucking cool, you know?
Yep.
So I think a lot of it was just like I just like cool shit. I like being cool. I like cool things. I like watching cool things.
Pause. You can't say that. You know, you can't say that without me giving you shit for it. Did you just say, you know, you're cool?
Nick, he said, I like being cool. He didn't say, I know I'm cool. To be fair,
I like being cool is
you just said it too.
Is the statement like proclaiming said cool, aforementioned coolness.
Put my name up and make that the quote of this podcast. Make that the title. I like being cool. Oh my God. Actually, you know what? I'm having second thoughts. I'm being very honest. That goes out.
I'm just kidding. He's very cool.
No, but to finish my, you know, it's like you're an Indian American kid, you're a brown kid growing up in the US, and you have certain access to culture. You have limited, you know, you kind of know what's cool, you kind of don't. You kind of have your parents' cool version of cool, which is Indian cool, which is a whole different cool, and then you have like American cool, which is a different cool. And I think you're just trying to like, just to take the cool thing one step further, I think you're just trying to figure out, you know, who you are, your identity, and watching films has always been that. I mean, I think the films of, say, like, you know, seeing a Spike Lee, She's Gotta Have It, or Do the Right Thing, or seeing like a Breathless by Jean-Luc Godard, or, you know, films by Chris Marker, Maya Deren, experimental work. Like, I think all of these films that I loved watching, that I saw, I was exposed to in film school, experimental films especially, just made me feel like I was in the right place. Like, these films I was watching all felt like they either made a statement, or they made a statement about art, or they were made out of material, or they were like, they were doing really subversive, cool shit, you know? Again, there's that word, cool. So I think I was really drawn to like the subversive nature of it, you know, but then also making film, you know, 16 millimeter is just like something special, 16 millimeter film, like hearing that film go through a camera, knowing you're burning film, knowing like how, you know, much film, how little film you can actually, like how precious a resource it is, and hearing that clicker go off and knowing that each shot is precious. Like, I just remember shooting my first films on film, like, that was another one of those moments where it was like, this feels right. This feels like what I want to be. This is making sense to me. Like, I know how to do this, you know?
What was the process and inspiration around Punching at the Sun, and also like your first Sundance experience? Because that must have been crazy.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big, wow. That was a big like highlight, turning point, send off in my career. I would say, you know, I got into film school, told you the story of that, you know, and while I was at film school, it was crazy. You know, I got there, 2 weeks after I got there, 9/11 happens. I literally, like, my dream was to go study film in New York. I was in India, got the call. You know, my experience in those years were forever going to be framed by those towers coming down. And I remember we class was canceled for the first week. I came back into the classroom. You know, my professor, I was wearing a hood. It was raining. My professor took one look at me and he said, if I saw someone that looked like you that walked onto an airplane, I would turn around and walk off. And he said that, you know, in class to everybody, there was one white girl who was like, oh, dear God, you know, nobody said anything otherwise, like nobody, like no one could. And I was in New York, new city, knew everything. And this shit just happened, you know, so I couldn't even really defend myself, you know, in that way. And this teacher, you know, an older Greek guy, and he went on to really kind of give me a hard, I don't know, I'm just putting this on the podcast, so it's recorded for posterity. It's coming into Punching at the Sun, though, in that, you know, I think, you know, I want to make sure it's known, because I think I would have handled it differently. And also, you know, I teach there from time to time, so it's kind of a funny full circle. But I did, you know, take a lot of, you know, the world changed on us, like, overnight. It changed on us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being South Asian in New York meant something different. Being South Asian in America meant something different. You know, it's all Islamophobia, ultimately, you know. There were a lot of new issues that were in my face I had to deal with. So I also, you know, I was working a lot. I worked in the equipment room. I tutored math on the side. I did a lot of jobs to support myself in the time. You know, I was really stressed and struggling. And I think I found school to be this big competition to see who can kind of get the grants for their junior and their thesis projects, you know. And it was very political. I just couldn't play the game like everyone else was playing it in real time. Mm-hmm. And plus, like, I'd already been making a lot of films, and I felt really strong in my craft already. I felt I was ready to make a feature. I'd done a short called Butterfly, starring Tolotha Mashom and Adil Hussein in their first kind of short film, actually, you know, and that had done really well. It played a lot of festivals. It won a lot of awards. I just felt like I was ramping up into some powers as a filmmaker. In the meantime, along with all this, I'd started volunteering at an organization called SAYA, South Asian Youth Action in Queens.
Yeah.
And we were taking youth to protests and to city halls, and they would ask simple questions like, where are my parents? You know, people are being detained and deported in these communities at unfair rates. And SAYA just at least provided a place for the youth to go to and at least process a lot of this and play basketball too. There was a basketball court over there that featured like an all South Asian basketball league that I was in love. I started filming the league, you know, for SAYA and documenting these kids. And I just felt like it was a special place at a special time. It was a place that was providing a lot of empowerment in a moment where kids like this were getting overlooked, you know? So over that course of that time, you know, I'd ended up moving to Queens with a roommate, and I'd befriended a couple of these youth, like, became really good friends. And I'd written a script that was set in California, but the storyline was really about a boy processing the murder of his older brother. And it was an unfathomable sort of incident. And he sort of dealing with loss and death and processing it as a 14-year-old in a 14-year-old's kind of frame. And I found that my story transposed to this neighborhood. And more than that, I started building it along the line, building it with teens that I knew. I begged and asked everyone if they would do it one summer. We'd submitted the script. It had gone to like the Tribeca All Access program, and then MTV was sort of interested in making it. And, you know, it was kind of like, oh shit, they just done Better Luck Tomorrow. And it was kind of like one of those things where it was like, oh, like, let's get on. Like, I have the script. Like, let's go, let's make this. And I just felt like they were dragging their feet. And part of this might've been just like being younger and just not understanding how fast things move at that level.
Yeah. But
you know, they weren't working. And I just knew I had a small window where I could shoot because my teens were going to grow into something else next summer. I had them here this summer. Teens, it's like nothing gets you working like a teen movie because you won't catch them.
Like, honestly, hiring kids who are going through or at the tail end of puberty is like the bane of filmmaking existence.
You gotta be careful. And fortunately, you know, I just went gung ho. I was like, fuck it. You know, I called Kodak. They gave me a bunch of 16mm film. I did some small bake sales. I made a few, $1,000 here and there. Was able to rent a private camera from somebody. You know, all of them, I had like 17 friends. All of them showed up for me. They all came, you know, every day for the production. I'm really lucky in that way. They just came and organized shit for me and did my shit and helped me. And these kids, they showed up every single day. One summer, we just went out and did it 17 days in the hot fucking sun. Like, didn't know what we were doing. We were shooting full 12, 13, 14-hour days. You know, we never went over. We didn't go crazy over, but it was like a real, true indie, rough and rugged production. It was that random thing. And I was hoping while we made it, you know, I was hoping, I was like, well, you know, my film got into the LA Asian American Film, but I just hope that like, this thing can play on the Asian circuit, you know, like and which is weird because it's not like a less than, and yet so many filmmakers, especially then, used to marginalize the Asian American filmmaking kind of circuit because they felt like it's not real unless you get into like a Tribeca or a Sundance or blah, blah, blah. But then I got into Sundance. I submitted it on a blank DVD. TV is punching at the sun. There was nothing on it. I just handed it, you know, put it in an envelope and mailed it. If you guys remember what mail is. And
why are you talking to me like we're like,
I don't know. I just, it,
I'm years just, old. Just
I'm really, yeah, I'm, I have this feeling. I'm like wondering, like, how old does Dennis think that we are?
Yes.
I've been alone all day. I'm talking to the audience. Then I got a call from John Cooper in the fall in the winter, and he was the fall, and he was like, "Yo, we loved you. Who are you? We loved your film. Do you want to play it at Sundance? You want to play it in Utah this January?" You know, and I was like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" Like, yes. And then I was like, "No, it's a totally better thing to get into Sundance than the Asian," you know. But it was an amazing moment. I fell to my knees as in my mama's, you know, playroom. And I was just fell to my knees. It was like a filmmaker's dream. Never could have imagined it. And was really we felt we'd made something special. I actually, in real time, we were like, we did something amazing. We did something that people aren't thinking about or doing in this moment. But, you know, I also felt like, I don't know if people will be ready to see this. I don't know if people will be ready to receive in this moment, you know, and it's going to be up to like, I think it's a great film, but it's going to be up to like tastemakers to take it to the next place. You know,
that's a real fear.
Yeah.
You know, as a first film, you're not thinking, I mean, this is in hindsight in reflection, you know,
right.
Because, you know, the beautiful thing is, so that film, you know, it played at Sundance. It went to the Asian American Film Festival, San Francisco. It went to Tribeca. It started winning all these awards. It started getting recognition, Humanitas Prize. All of a sudden, you know, I was on the map as a filmmaker. In at least in my little indie world, and you know, all those expectations. What's the next film? What's next? What's your next script? What's going on? What's happening? Like, who are you? There's so much that happens after that you're not really ready for. I was barely ready to premiere the film. You know, we could barely get a color correction done. You know, for this thing, it was really tight. You know, all around. But now, you know, looking back. The thing that felt amazing about it was that I felt like what was going on the screen was exactly what was in my heart. Like there was no distance from what I wanted to put up and what I saw, which is a great feeling. I think it's very rare. It doesn't always happen. So
yeah,
that was, you know, something you kind of chase from there on out. But then the great news, you know, the most recent news is that the film has been selected as part of a series on the Criterion Collection.
Yeah, it has.
You know, it took some years. It took some time. But you know, that's what the criterion is there for, is to look back at the, look back at these eras and see what was there and what was missed. And quite frankly, it's a time that Criterion isn't checking for Asian American filmmakers. They're not checking for anything, but you know, they're kind of like they've finally started opening up their programming too, which has opened up, you know, lanes for a film like Punching at the Sun. But yeah, you know, it's crazy to reflect on it. My heart does so many gymnastics when I think about it. There was so much joy in making it. There was so much pain in making it as well. And, you know, it's taken a long time to learn about what I did and learn about myself and grow even since then. You know, it feels like you just climbed Mount Everest, but then you look up and you're like, fuck, now there's 100 other things that people, you know, that I got to do, you know? And yeah, anyway, I don't know if this is kind of a gloss. If I answered the country
100%. Question, 100%. And I also think I just want to give another shout out about getting into Sundance, because like truly, I think the thing that sometimes people kind of can forget or not realize is those festivals can be very political. It can be very much like who you know. Are you somebody? Are you this? Are you that? And to be selected is huge. It is actually genuinely just a huge accomplishment. And I want to reiterate that truly like it's so,
I'm taking that because that's damn true. I didn't know anybody there. It was a DVD that they didn't know me from Hill of Beans. And I do think that things can definitely, there are programmed stuff. There are things that are hard to get around with sometimes, but then, you know, there's always a few slots for discovery. They make some space for discovery, less and less over the years. I'm fortunate to come out in a time when there was discovery. And I think a lot of filmmakers have to think about presenting yourself as a discovery too. I think a lot of times people get so, I remember feeling like this, where you just feel like you've arrived before you've done anything. And it's strategically, it's good for, you know, often for people to learn about your work instead of them hearing it all about you from your mouth. Like, let them push play and let the work do the talking. I think, it means a lot, Kirtana, because I've always been somebody who I feel like I want the work to speak for me, you know? And that was one thing I took a lot of pride in. We were the first South Asian American feature film to go to that festival, and we took our kids there.
I was talking to a filmmaker yesterday, and something that he brought up to me was how after he made his first film, he felt like he had more anxiety around making the second film because he felt like he had used all of his resources and all of his contacts to make that first film. And it's exactly like what you said, right? Like when you make the first one, everyone's like, all right, can they do it again? What's next? And I'm so curious, because you set the bar so high for yourself, was there anxiety around what that next thing was going to be?
Yeah, damn, that's a real ass question. Yeah, it was nuts. It was insane. That was a lot to live up to, and not even just getting people together, resources together. Like, what are you going to make your film about? Like, what do you follow up something that everyone is really super excited about? So, and how do you put that energy into another project? Because your first film is you're doing so much without knowing. Like, you're feeling in the dark. You're trying to grow from a short to a feature, and there's a magic about not knowing that allows you to take risks and do things as a first-time filmmaker that you'll never do again. You just won't. You just can't. You shouldn't. And you shouldn't want to. Because quite frankly, you know, a lot of those awesome creative, you know, tangents you take as a kid often come from a lack of polish as well, which is good in your first film, but you also still have to polish. I mean, just because I could like hustle and make a good film that got into Sundance, like I still needed to grow as an artist. I still needed to learn how to nail really great performances with professional actors and lighting. Like I still had to think about how to structure a scene through a day. Like there's still so much to learn even after that. And yet I'm supposed to be this like wonder kid, this like kid who's supposed to know everything about filmmaking and supposed to have his next film lineup. Like, no, to be honest, like I went home after Punching at the Sun. I spent another year in New York, year and a half. I was doing like a lot of youth workshops I was still teaching kids how to make film. I went back to my hometown. I went to this, you know, I went to this school, Menlo Atherton, which has a, you know, at-risk community. We started filmmaking workshops for these kids, just teaching them how to like make documentaries about their life. We got laptops and cameras, and we would teach them about, you know, how to edit and shoot their stories and just like doing really grounded, like after Punching at the Sun, I was like doing really grounded shit in my hometown for like years, you know? And I don't know if that was the smartest move. I wouldn't give myself that advice. I would never say, son, you should go back home and go under a rock after you've made a film that went to Sundance. I don't know. I wouldn't tell that to anybody, but of course I did it. And I think it's like you said, Nikki, when we started, like maybe I've flown a little bit lower or like I don't jump into the attention or you know, also the work hasn't brought that yet. I think it's been great. It's been good. It's been beneficial. Like in that time at home, I did some real humble shit. Like I was shooting wedding videos. I was shooting, you know, real estate videos. Oh my God. I shot one guy. The best compliment I've got to this day is I played a cut of this guy who hired me to do his real estate video. This big broker in town. And he looked at me. He was like, this is the best real estate video I've ever seen in my life. But he was moved to tears from it, you know, and like that shit felt better than a lot of other things in this filmmaking world has felt, to be honest. I still wanted to make another film. I even tried. DSLR movement was happening at this point, and there was so many. Yeah, it just enabled you as a film. If you love shooting, if you love making films, like I got to shoot like a web series for Cam called Nice Girls Crew, starring Sheetal Shet, Lin Chen, and Michelle Kruzek, that was super funny. Everybody was like laughing at it like crazy at the festival. I got to shoot Grass, my like 420, you know, stoner picture. On a DSLR, I got to shoot.
Hell yeah!
Yeah, it what I would give the advice I would give the younger me would be like, get your shit together, get some headshots, go to LA, get your film under your fucking arm, and go knock on every single door and go be fucking, you know, sell your shit, like go be charming, do something, you know. That's not what I did. I took a lot of time. I only came back to LA, or only came to LA after the VC Film Festival, the LA Film Festival of Los Angeles, had given me a really great grant to make a feature, TNT. That was like a big deal at the time. They'd given me like a really nice, I forgot the name of the grant, but it you know, it was a $100,000 grant to go make a feature. It was a lot of money for me. We got excited. I came to LA, and I think that, you know, you're talking about when you started making films or when you started in the industry. Well, you know, I think my time like really interfacing with the industry that way started more around then.
Well, it's interesting because we're talking about like, you know, you coming to LA and you know, setting up whatever shop business we do here in the city. But the cool thing about you is that you have worked globally, because one of my favorite shows that came out around, you know, in the last couple of years, particularly out of India, is Delhi Crime. And the thing I was like excited to talk to you about, not only Punching at the Sun, but was Delhi Crime, and to find out what that opportunity was like to get that.
I mean, yeah. I mean, they even call it a web series, right? In India, they call Netflix calls their shows web series.
Yeah. So when they started
talking about it, they're like, yeah, it's a web series. It's a web series. It's a web series. Everyone would call it a web series. And I'd be like, what web are you talking about? Like, this is on my Netflix TV screen. This is a TV show, homie. This is a show. So I shoot this web series called Delhi Crime. I don't know, Kirtan, it's such a complex question, because it's actually a very simple, it's a very straightforward question, but it's my answers, my feelings around it all are so complicated, because I mean, getting the opportunity was awesome. You know, it's this story, right? It's like we were saying, like all you need is that one opportunity, that one thing, you know? So fast forward, I had done Chi and T and Grass were both features that I had done. They both won grand jury prizes. TNT won Grand Jury Prize at the San Diego Asian American. Grass won at Austin. You know, these films, I kept winning awards, you know, for these films. And it's not easy to do. It's not easy to go out there, keep putting up features and keep getting awards at festivals. That's not, it's not simple, you know, I'm not in the mainstream making these films, but I at that point I had put out four feature films. They'd all won Grand Jury Prize awards. And to me that, I was like proud of myself, but the cool thing is other people were watching, you know, other people are watching. They were watching. People did see my short Butterfly. People did see me, you know, make Punching at the Sun, and I've gone to a lot of festivals. I'd been out there talking about my work. I didn't go to Hollywood per se, knock on doors, but I was at festivals, like rubbing elbows with filmmakers, having those core conversations, you know. God, this is back when we used to be able to go to festivals like that. I think the producers of the show, you know, when Richie had to drop out of it, it was a very difficult thing because nobody knew sort of how to replace someone like that, or, you know, replace a creator. But they had sort of seen my career from afar. They'd noticed I'd been making similar moves. Richie had been doing work in India. I'd done work in India. Richie had been a lot of indie films. I don't like it. Just my sensibility kind of made sense to them, you know. And on top of that, I'd also gotten into every like directing program you can get into in Hollywood. Like I'd done Fox Labs, you know, I'd done HBO Labs, I'd done Sony Labs. And all these are kind of created with the intention to bring people, give people a chance to direct, you know, something direct, you know, in the industry, direct for a TV show. All of, you know, a skill set which I feel like I'd been shadowing. Like, I couldn't even get a job directing an episode of anything, you know, after all that work. Yeah. And this is what, and for the first time, I think it's probably what, like, white dudes feel or something, you know. It's like, I felt like I had white privilege. Like, all of a sudden I was allowed to, like, show run a major show without, you know, and knowing I had the experience, knowing I've been making work, I've been making films, I've been being a showrunner for my work my whole time, this whole time, you know, whether that title had been put on it or not. It just took some, you know, a different team to see my work and put it in context. I had to go through, you know, interview process and some rounds. They had to also move, and then we just got to work. It's a tremendous adjustment when something like that happens. The feeling of getting the opportunity, like, it just, you just feel seen. You finally feel seen. You know, it was an opportunity that, it wasn't like, oh my God, I'm so grateful. It was like I'm ready. I've been ready for this. I've been ready to do this, you know? And the big draw were the actors on the show. I mean, one thing Richie did great was cast that thing. He cast the most amazing. Richie did a lot of good things, but casting was exceptional. I was so excited to work with this cast.
And I mean, you spoke a little bit about like going to festivals and rubbing shoulders with people. And Kiers and I have talked about this so much, the importance of showing up and building your own community. Like, don't, if you feel like you can't, like, there's no such thing as entering a community. Like, you start to create your own, and that's your circle and your people. And, like, Kiersten and I actually met at a film festival, and that's how we got connected. And I think, and you and I, Thunage, we were on a virtual panel. Like, they're, you know, even attending festivals that way. I saw so many filmmakers reaching out to each other on Facebook and through email and all this mm-hmm. stuff. Like, it's so important to go to these things and meet people who are doing the same thing as you, because you are all going to end up, you know, helping each other. We talk about, like, my class, like, this is my group of people that rose up with me, and you get to see everyone rise up together, but you have to work together and reach out to each other to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And I mean, it's funny, 'cause like Nikki and I, you know, we went to a festival together, and that's where I met our dear friend and filmmaker who I now got to work on his debut feature. And like, that would not have happened without going to a film festival. And shout out to Product of Culture and South Asian Film Festival of America, because like, legitimately, none of that would have happened.
We literally ran to the front of the stage at the end of Nardeep's screening of Pug, and we were like, we got to get this guy's email. Like, he is someone to watch, blah, blah, blah. And now y'all made like a feature together, and that's crazy.
Well, the other thing too, you know, the other thing about festivals, and I hear this a lot from filmmakers, like, I'm not going to go to Sundance until my film gets in, or like, I'm not going to attend that until they, and it's such a bad move. Like, you need to go to these festivals, not just to meet people. Honestly, you need to go see what programmers are programming. What are they interested in? What are the moods for the year? What are the other filmmakers doing? Like, you need to know what other filmmakers are actually physically making, how good their films are, to understand where you have to, like, where you fall, what you stand, what you believe in, and how far away are you from making the kind of work that can get in or not get in, you know?
Absolutely.
God, you look at some of these lineups, I've been a juror on a festival for a long time now. Like, if people knew how competitive these things, like, these things are competitive for a reason. They're competitive because the other films are really good, you know? Once you kind of can get a sense of, like, okay, this is the taste profile of the festival. This is, like, what programmers are looking for. Maybe meet programmers, get to know what they like, you know?
Yeah.
It can help you create, it can help you evolve the work. It can help you come up with an idea that might be a good film to make for you, you know, emotionally, personally. But it's also something that has maybe a smart, you know, festival strategy behind it or business behind it.
Absolutely.
You know, the most fun I have at festivals is like, ideal day at Sundance is waking up at, like, you know, being up till whenever, waking up hella early, getting a cup of coffee, being up there, being on Main Street for like a really crazy horror screening at like 7 a.m, you know, and then stacking the day with screenings all the way up until, you know, night. Like, I just want to, and if I have to wait in lines for those, like, I love this part of it all. Like, anyway, I just
going. Yeah, no, and I 100%. And one of the things that I was like very lucky that I got to do when I lived in New York too, was I volunteered for festivals. Yeah. So like, I volunteered for Tribeca. I volunteered for New York Film for a few years. And you get to meet people that way too, especially as you're like figuring out what department you get to volunteer in. Sometimes you can kind of float and do those kinds of things. And you get to like walk in and like check out screenings too, if you don't have like the money necessarily to go, because that's always the big challenge, right? Is like, how do I get to go see these things when I can't afford $4,000 to go get a pass at Sundance or something, right? But a lot of big cities have these incredible film festivals. Go and volunteer, because it gives you a good opportunity to meet people and to get to know programmers, because you're literally working with them, and to sneak into, it's not really sneaking, but sneak into, you know, press and industry screenings for these projects. So you can kind of get a good sense of that. And that was like instrumental for me for a few years.
Personal development, right? It's personal development. Yeah. Like, people spend so much money on crap. This is actually, it's a big investment in yourself. It's also just I would say go see anything too. Like, see something that you wouldn't normally see. Try to understand why it's at the festival, you know?
Right. That's a great point.
There's so much learning that can be done from a film that's not your type of film, or a film that's not your genre of film. Like, understand why, especially a place like Sundance. There's it's political, but those films get in for a reason. Like, I've watched all, like, they're really, really, really exceptionally made small films. Like, it's hard to make films that land. It's hard to make moments that land. And, you know, 9 to 10 times out of 10, you know, most Sundance films are like, you know, hitting their beats, whether you like the film or not, whether it's good or not, whether it's your taste or not. Technically, as a filmmaker, like, these films get in because they do certain things, you know.
Just to go back to Deli Crime for a quick second, you mentioned that you show ran the show. For the people listening who don't know what that means, what is the job of a showrunner? At least, like, what's like the zoom out? What do you do?
I just had to make sure my Air Force One stayed crispy. That's the main
thing. Atta boy.
Remember, Dunnage likes being cool. So.
Oh my God. What do you think? I think every show has a different demand of its showrunner. And every demand is different depending on the day of a showrunner. You know, you're kind of this person who's like, kind of on call for any issue your show might have. You know, a showrunner generally is somebody who's understands the complete vision of the season, complete vision of the show, interprets the story, is the custodian for the story, knows every episode inside out, knows every beat inside out, and is somebody who's constantly managing that creative output, making sure the show maintains the integrity that it's going into production with. If you're somebody like me inheriting a show like Deli Crime, well, there's already a language of the show that's already built in. There's already actors with characters that they understand, you know, better than you even understand. So a lot of it, and again, you have EPs, you have bosses, you have people who expect a certain thing from the show as well. Often, you know, it's about, can you give them their show that they've shot? Can you give them what feels like their show again, you know? So it's very much not like about, look, here's punching at the sun. Here's my statement of, you know, what's in my heart. But in a lot of ways it is, because a show like Deli Crime also demands a filmmaker's sensibility, demands a certain kind of aesthetic, a quality, a handheld filmmaking vibe, you know. That's where my real strength is just in the field, in production. You know, you get to a point where you just make sure you're not making mistakes, you know. So it goes between things, you know. Sometimes it's really stupid problem solving, like something you forgot and you have to kind of make a fix for. At its best, the job is a place where you can like sing, articulate yourself, find new tones, put actors in spaces that are like sublime, you know. I feel like a show like Deli Crime demands a certain rigor and it demands a certain quality. I have to get into a real documentary, live, like really awesome, fun filmmaking space for it, you know.
And so
that was demanded of me on this.
Yeah. I mean, you're a massive creative manager. Like, you have to take care of the writer's room and make sure that you're delivering creatively on what the show should look like. You have to manage those network personalities and have those conversations with executives and make sure that you're fulfilling what the network bought, but also staying true to what the creative vision is. Like, I can't stress that enough. Like, showrunners are the most, maybe you'll disagree with me because you're humble like that, but showrunners are the most important people on a TV show, and they really are the person who executes. Like, that's the person who makes sure that the creative is being executed, and you're involved in every facet of that. Thunder, shut up. You're literally,
you know me, Nikki. You know I already thought I was the most important person before.
Oh my God, shut up. You're literally the most humble person on this earth.
We'll put it this way so that no one needs to have any shut up about this. It's every job is important, but it's the job that probably not arguably has the most responsibility and the most weight on its shoulder.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of, you know, you have to be a good communicator. You have to make sure your execs know what you're doing and why you're doing
it.
You have to make sure both network and your execs And the job is like, I'm humble because it's naturally humbling job. Like you just, talk about taking a no or taking rejection. I mean, you have like show running, you have to be able to absorb bad news, failures, issues. You have to absorb, like a pandemic hit us in the middle of shooting.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
You know, I had to sit there and hold the show together with my execs over a long period of confusion and stagnation. Some shows would have just been thrown out. Some shows, you know, a lot of shows got just canceled.
Obviously. Like some shows were thrown out. Yeah,
I was gonna say I was working on one that got thrown out.
So. We're very fortunate, you know, that Delhi Crime does what it does. We're lucky the show has some meaning for people because it could have gone too. I mean, anything can go.
I mean, I'm very excited to see what you guys have done with it because I know it's going to be just a huge success.
Well, listen, let's just. I like we talk about following up, punching at the sun, and this is more follow up pressure, man. Like,
well, no, I mean, I just it's you, of course, but I think also just the team that you have compiled is very exciting, and there's a lot of cool shit that has come out of India recently. So it's an exciting thing to like anticipate. You know what I mean?
It's coming out cool. We're just putting the finishing touches literally as I speak. Yeah, you know, let's see what people say.
So now I'm gonna put a ton of pressure on you. No, but like also no pressure. What advice would you give to young filmmakers wanting to, you know, do what you did with your life?
Oh, wow.
No pressure. It's not no, like a big this question is not pressure. Or anything. This is not pressure.
And you've given us some, for sure, like some very important nuggets of like about accepting the no's and things like that. But on top of that, what else?
Yeah, well, I mean, if they're listening this far into the conversation, that means something is working. They haven't shut me off.
Listen, they come for us and they stay for you.
Shut me up here. But I feel like, I don't know, you know, it's a crazy world, you know, like the cynic in me is like, just start a TikTok page and go ham, you know?
It's not wrong. Like, hey, make shit. Yeah. Make shit. Like, that's it.
Like, film school worked for me. It was great because I was coming up in a time when if you were a person of color or someone from a marginalized group, if you want to tell a story, look, the industry is not going to be the most nurturing place for you to develop an idea. Like, film school, you know, has its flaws, but at least you're sort of in a safe bubble where you can, like, really dream up something different. I don't think that's the state of affairs today. And I don't think there's anything I'm getting in film school that you can't, you know, go onto YouTube and run some tutorial. I still use YouTube tutorials to this very day. I think the best advice that's not given, because I think we speak in these like geometric terms, like we're graphing shit, almost like we're in a BC calculus class. It's not.
Oh my God.
It's not about that. You know, like filmmaking is not, like, I think you have to be about something. I think you have to really investigate like who you are, what you're about, live your life, live out loud, like, or live quietly, whatever it is that's you, that's you doing you. I think you need to invest time and develop character, develop your character as a human, as a maker, as a member of your community. Know who your aces are, know who your best friends are, know who your parents are. And it sounds crazy, but like seriously, a lot of people don't know who their parents are, you know, like and get a sense of who you are in the world. You know, we always talk about voice. And then we talk pitch decks and treatments. And like, I think, like I said, all of that, nobody knows what they're saying yes to. People can greenlight you to the moon. The moment you get on set, that's what matters. That's when your character shows up. And if you've been yesed all the way to the top and you show up on set and you can't shoot your way out of a hairy corner, good luck. It's going to suck. You know, so I just think like we have put a premium on getting someplace really fast. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Yep.
And I'm saying this, you know, maybe having gotten places fast, but I don't think that that's why I got to these places. I think like my highs and lows, my social successes and failures have been the most important part of defining me, you know, and defining myself, not defined by others per se, but reflecting and interacting with the world. So I just would tell young filmmakers to just stay out of your phones 24/7. As you know, it's a tool. It's such a great tool. On one hand, like all you need is a great script, you know, and you can film something on an iPhone that goes viral. You know, I love the idea of that. On the other hand, I just think like art is in the living. You have to like go out there and experience life, be alive, be in life, be vocal, be cool. Be cool for a little
while. There it is.
Because nobody wants another insufferable filmmaker.
I think you should do, how do we reach out to Masterclass and get Thunderdin episode? How to
be cool.
how to be cool. I'd take that masterclass.
Like, I would so take tips on Yuta, how to be
cool. It's so funny.
About Kenny G again.
Every time you say cool, for some reason my head immediately goes to 21 Jump Street where Channing Tatum's like, don't put your backpack on both of your shoulders, man. Like, that's not cool. You got to one strap it. And so every time you say cool, I'm like, you're talking about one strapping it. Like, that's where my head is going.
That's my advice to young filmmakers. One strap that motherfucker. Like, put it on one strap.
That's such a good point. I feel like, especially when I talk to kids in college or in film school, they get so trapped in the mechanics and the idea of being in film school. In the process, when they pitch their work, they say, oh, it's like Wes Anderson, or oh, it's like this. Like, they aspire to do what has already been done and forget that the reason those people became so successful and iconic is because they did stuff that nobody else was doing. And you can't do that unless you're living life and expanding your social circles and living outside of film and TV and just really experiencing life. That's the only way you can get your voice. Don't compare yourself to somebody that's already done it.
And shit is evolving. Shit's evolving all the time. And that's why I like people like, you know, like Quinta Brunson, who just like did shit on Instagram, did shit on BuzzFeed. And now Abbott Elementary is like one of the best new shows that I've seen. I love that show.
There's so many routes now, right? I mean, that's what I'm thinking. Like, she had a vision for her show, but she lived it. You know, she knew she could get that vision across in multiple ways. Put me on an Instagram, absolutely. Put me in a pure pitch, you know? And so, but I think that kind of personality only comes from like throwing yourself, you know, into and out of the fire as much as you can in your life, being boisterous, being vocal, being rowdy, or be, if you're an introvert, be the biggest introvert in the world and show us cool. I just want people to lean into their personalities and lean into the things that make them.
Well, all I wanted to do was get Abbott Elementary into the conversation. So I made it. I did it. That was my goal.
And it was appropriate. It didn't feel out of, I mean, talking about Abbott Elementary is always appropriate, but that was great.
Abbott Elementary, Severance. Those are my shows for the new year. Those are the ones that I've been watching. And then Deli Crime when that comes out. There you go.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a blast. You're the best. This is great.
I hope it's useful. You know, I just, anytime I can get a chance to kind of retrace my steps with cool people, it's like a real gift. It's a real privilege. So thanks, guys, for creating space. Curating people is the, Himanshu said this to me, curating people is the highest form of art. And I think that's what you guys are doing. Curating.
I have chills.
I like that.
Himanshu has a way sometimes.
The Chat Room is hosted by me, Nikki Menon,
and me, Kirtana Sastry,
in partnership with Brown Girl Magazine.
Pallavi Sastry is our consulting producer.
All podcast artwork is created by Aishwarya Sukesh, and opening music is by Shridath Bambipadi.
Special thanks to Thrisha Sukujawalia. Please subscribe to The Chat Room on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening right now.
Thanks for tuning in.